Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff, read by Gretchen Miller, featuring Smitten Kitchen. Today, we're going to start off with a recipe for lamb chops with pistachio tapenade. One thing I'm realizing about going a long time without eating meat, 15 years, followed by a relatively short time eating as a moderately enthusiastic meat eater, 5 years and change, is that it doesn't always occur to you to include it in meals. In fact, I've apparently made only 4 dishes on the site this year that include meat, and 2 were briskets for big dinner parties. With the fridge bursting with spinach and scallions, radishes, real baby carrots, sugar snaps, shelling peas, and tiny freshly dug red potatoes rolling off the top, I can hardly imagine why I need to roast a chicken. But when I was going through my very, very, very long list of recipes I want to try last week, these lamb chops jumped out at me, promising to at least temporarily break me out of my asparagus, hashed, ribboned, tossed with pasta for one, rut. There were 3 big sells on this recipe for me. The first being Anne Burrell. I love everything she cooks. The second was that these chops are entirely made in the kitchen, and I had no idea that you could make great lamb chops without a grill. Related, reason number 3, is that I only recently discovered that I love lamb chops, adore them. In fact, I think my enjoyment of lamb chops versus dabbling in ribs or a vague appreciation of steak is pretty much the only thing that makes me a real meat eater these days, which I define as liking the taste of something so much you'd even enjoy it plainly, just salt and pepper on a grill. That's love, right? Fortunately, this recipe has a little fun with them, smearing them once browned with olive pistachio lemon zest and garlic tapenade that you can whip up in no time in a food processor. Chops are browned for 2 minutes on each side in a pan, slathered with the tapenade, and baked for 5 minutes to utter lamb perfection. The whole dish can literally be pulled off in 30 minutes, leaving time for the important stuff like sitting in the grass and pondering how your thighs got so awesome. What, you do that too, don't you? Here's the recipe, lamb chops with pistachio tapenade. Barely tweaked from Anne Burrell. 1/2 cup of pistachios, shelled and toasted. 1/2 cup of pitted greens, what I used, or Serignola, what Burrell recommends, olives. 2 tablespoons of capers. 1 clove of garlic mashed, smashed, 1 tablespoon of freshly chopped oregano leaves, nixed because mine had gone bad, 2 tablespoons of freshly chopped parsley leaves, extra virgin olive oil, 1 lemon zested, 1 8-ounce rack of lamb or 6 lamb chops, salt, and freshly ground black pepper. To make the pistachio tapenade in a food processor, combine the pistachios, olives, capers, garlic, herbs, and puree. While the machine is running, slowly drizzle in olive oil until the mixture becomes a paste. Add the zest and pulse one more time, drizzling in more oil if necessary, and reserve until ready to use. If you're using a rack of ribs, you're going to remove 2 rib bones from the 8-rib rack to make it a 6-rib rack. Counting from either end, remove the 2nd and 7th bones. This will create 6 even chops that are thicker than a normal lamb chop. Cut 6 even chops. Cook your chops. You're going to season your 6 lamb chops generously on either side with salt and freshly ground black pepper. Allow them to sit for 10 to 15 minutes before cooking. Preheat your oven to 425 degrees Fahrenheit and coat a large saute pan generously with olive oil and bring it to medium-high heat. When the oil is hot but not smoking, add the lamb chops and cook for about 2 minutes on each side until brown. If the pan begins to smoke, you're going to lower the heat. The chops should be beautifully caramelized on both sides. Remove the chops to a sheet pan and smear generously with the pistachio tapenade. Place in the preheated oven and cook for another 4 to 5 minutes for medium rare. Remove the chops from the oven and let rest at least 5 minutes before serving. So for my addition, does anyone know why not a single Anne Burrell recipe calls for black pepper, only salt? I'd love to hear your theories. After raking through my extensive notes from the weekend's grilling class, it's even clearer than before what a grilling 101 it was. Chock full of building blocks. The recipes, though, were anything but introductory, and I've included one of my favorites at the end. So with little further ado, 5 totally nerdy bits of grilling information that I learned this weekend. Number 1. Do you know why gas grills don't sear as well as charcoal grills? To get a good sear, you need a raging hot fire and a dry surface. Charcoal burns drier than gas. Gas is about 30% moisture, releasing 1/2 to 1 cup of water every 10 minutes that the grill is on, and this water adds steam to the cooking process. Number 2. There are 5 ways only to cook with fire. Right in the fire, right near the fire, like toasting a marshmallow, directly over fire, indirectly, with no heat directly underneath, and an oven setup where the walls are heated. Indirectly was totally new to me because I'm obviously not from the South or the Southeast, two regions where they would never call throwing burgers and hot dogs on directly over a blazing grill barbecue. But number 3, there are 6 grilling techniques. Direct, which is what we are the most used to, and it's a lot like broiling. Indirect, which is great for denser, bigger foods that take a long time to cook. Rotisserie, which is great for even browning and adds smoke, which is a great technique for gas grills, which impart no aroma. Barbecuing, usually with a pit smoker and an offset firebox, whereby food cooks for a long time over a very low, highly flavored heat, and cooking in the coals, in which you ditch the grill grate and do just what it sounds like. Number 4, when considering grill fuels, it's good to know the pros and cons of each. Propane grills are the most popular in the U.S., but they have the aforementioned water content issues. Gas grills are also common, connected directly to the gas line of the house. My parents, EMTs, and my father, the volunteer fireman, would probably like to add that directly connected gas lines can be serious fire hazards. Charcoal comes in 2 forms, briquettes and a lump charcoal. Of the former, some are made with cheap scrap wood and all sorts of other fillers, not to mention borax as a binder. Lump charcoal is their preference, as it has no additives and it burns much hotter. Wood produces some of the most incredible flavors, tastes that vary from wood to wood. However, fresh wood is 50% water, and it's harder to light, and it doesn't burn easily. Seasoned wood actually burns hotter than lump charcoal. Number 5, get this. Higher heat doesn't make something cook faster. Why? Because conduction, one of the 3 types of heat transfers that occurs in grilling, isn't very effective, and little can be done to speed up the process, as food isn't much of a conductor. Raising the temperature just traps more heat and makes the edges browner. However, convection, or circulated heat, that works even better with a lid, creating an oven-like state, is more effective, as is radiation, which is heat that comes off the fire but never directly touches the food, such as the warmth that emanates from the sun. This is the part of class that sounded the most like science lab because they started talking about the electromagnetic spectrum. Thus, I did what I always did then. I zoned out and doodled. Look, I drew our teachers as grills, and there's a couple pictures of grills with faces on them. Finally, and no, I'm not just telling you this because my weekend was like a sponsored promotion of this book. If you have any interest at all in cooking outside, You have got to buy Mastering the Grill. It's absolutely loaded, like 400 pages stuffed with mind-blowing amounts of building blocks and helpful tidbits like those above, but 10,000 more. Usually when we read about grilling, it's about barbecuing or the culture around Southern and Southeastern grilling. But this is about the technique, science, and approaches to cooking with fire, which means that it is endlessly useful whether you put peaches, focaccia, brisket, or corn on the grill. This book isn't about regional sauces or techniques, but how to wield fire to your cooking advantage. So, smoke roasted bell peppers stuffed with garden vegetables is the recipe I'm going to share. This is from Mastering the Grill by Andrew Schloss and David Joachim. Yes, I know. Where's the beef? Well, after a weekend of burgers, chicken, sausage, and ribs, I'm still in the land of meat over, and even the thought of it makes me groan a little. This, however, is something I can't wait to make again, a lighter, crunchier, and healthier variety of stuffed pepper, and pretty as a picture. Again, smoke-roasted bell peppers stuffed with garden vegetables. This makes 8 small servings. You'll need 2 medium red bell peppers, 3 medium mixed bell peppers, orange, yellow, and green, 3/4 teaspoon of kosher salt, 1/2 teaspoon of ground black pepper, 3 tablespoons of butter, 1 onion, finely chopped, 2 cloves of garlic, minced, 1 medium zucchini, cut into 1/4 inch dices, 1 medium yellow squash, also cut into 1/4 inch dice, 2 cups of fresh or frozen corn kernels, from 3 to 4 ears of corn for extra flavor. Once you've cut the kernels off, use the dull side of your knife blade to scrape the remaining corn and juices or milk from the cob. You'll need 1 medium tomato, seeded and cut into 1/4 inch dice, 2 tablespoons of chopped fresh herbs such as parsley, oregano, basil, or a mix, and 1/4 cup of plain dried breadcrumbs and oil for the coating the grill grate, and 2 tablespoons of grated Parmesan cheese. This is optional. If you're using a gas grill, use indirect heat on the medium. That's 325 to 350 degrees Fahrenheit. A 2-to-4 burner grill, use the middle burners turned off, or a 2 burner grill with one side off and a clean oiled grate. If you're using a charcoal grill, use indirect heat, medium ash, split charcoal bed, about 2 dozen coals per side, with a clean oiled grate on medium setting. First, you're going to heat the grill as directed, and then soak 2 cups of apple or oak wood chips or chunks in water for an hour. Seed, core, and cut one of the red bell peppers into a 1/4 inch dice, and cut the remaining bell peppers in half lengthwise right through the stem, leaving a bit of stem attached to each half. Cut the core, seeds, and ribs from the interiors of the peppers, leaving the stem intact. Sprinkle the insides of the peppers with 1/4 teaspoon of the salt and 1/4 teaspoon of the pepper. Melt the butter in a large skillet over medium heat and add the onion and saute until almost tender, about 4 minutes. Add the garlic, chopped bell pepper, zucchini, and yellow squash. Saute the vegetables until crisp tender, about 4 minutes, and then stir in the corn and tomato and cook until heated through about 1 to 2 minutes. Stir in the herbs, breadcrumbs, and the remaining 1/4 teaspoon salt and 1/4 teaspoon pepper. Cook and stir until the breadcrumbs soak up most of the liquid in the pan, and remove from the heat and spoon the filling equally into the pepper cavities. When the grill is hot, put the soaked wood chips or chunks over the coal on both sides of the grill. If using gas, put the wood chips in a smoker box or in a perforated foil packet directly over one of the heated burners. Brush the grill grate and coat it with oil, and put the stuffed peppers over the unheated part of the grill. Cover and cook until just tender, 20 to 30 minutes. If your grill has a temperature gauge, it should stay around 350 degrees Fahrenheit. Remove the peppers to a large serving platter and then sprinkle with Parmesan if you're using, and serve. Next, we've got a recipe for carrot soup with miso and sesame. I hadn't meant for this soup to be so quintessentially early January. That would be virtually fat-free, dairy-free, gluten-free, miso-dependent, vegan, and the very picture of healthful do-gooding. It's about one cube of tofu away from earning a halo, or at least being surrounded by singing cherubs. In fact, if you advertised a soup to me with all of those qualities, I would probably run in the other direction, because I'm a dietary heathen and I love butter, even if overdoing it in December now requires it in moderation for the rest of time. In fact, the reason why I made this soup is because, in general, I don't find carrot soups all that interesting, and I wanted to challenge myself to make one I'd love and eat often. I tuned to one of my favorite dressing recipes for inspiration, the ginger carrot miso awesomeness most of us know from sushi restaurants, and decided to mash up a miso and carrot soup. Usually when you finish a soup like this and a relatively simple saute of onion and garlic, a simmering of vegetables in broth, followed by a run in the blender, cream or creme fraiche or sour cream goes in, and you could do that here, but I don't want to bury the brightness of the miso paste. So I instead drizzled some toasted sesame oil on it, which is frankly like crack to me, and scattered some thinly sliced scallions. The soup is good without them, but with them, it all comes together harmoniously, dancing off into a 4:40 p.m. 27 degree sunset. Goodness, that sounded depressing, but I promise it's a lot less so with this soup on the stove. Here's the recipe, carrot soup with miso and sesame. Usually, recipe writers urge you to season food throughout, building layers of flavor. Here, don't. The miso that we add at the end is very salty, and it's safest to decide how much seasoning your soup needs after that. Note, this soup is gluten-free with a large caveat, and that is that most miso is in part from barley and is not gluten-free. You will need to seek out a miso brand, such as one from Eden, that is clearly marked as such for it to be good to go. Good tip there, Deb. So here's for the soup. You will need 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 2 pounds of carrots, peeled and thinly sliced, 1 large onion, finely chopped, 4 regular or 6 small garlic cloves, peeled and smashed, 1 tablespoon of finely grated or grated, or finely chopped or grated ginger, or more to taste. It could easily be doubled if you're a fan of ginger. 4 cups of vegetable broth, 1/4 cup of white miso paste, or more to taste. To finish, a drizzle of toasted sesame oil, 2 scallions very thinly sliced. You're going to heat oil in a heavy, large saucepan over medium heat. Add the carrots, onion, and garlic, saute until onion is translucent, about 10 minutes. Add broth and ginger. Cover and simmer until the carrots are tender when pierced, stirring occasionally about 30 minutes. Puree the soup in batches in a blender or all at once with an immersion blender. In a small bowl, whisk together the miso and 1/2 cup of the soup. Stir the mixture back into the pot of soup and taste the soup and season with salt, pepper, or additional miso to taste. You're going to ladle it into bowls and garnish each with a drizzle of sesame oil and a small mound of scallions. As far as pickled scallions, I didn't do this in the end, but it was tempted to lightly pickle the scallions by letting them hang out in a mixture of 6 tablespoons of rice vinegar, 2 tablespoons of water, 1 tablespoon of kosher salt. I use Diamond Brand, so use less if you're using Wharton or another, which are more dense. And 1.5 teaspoons of sugar, just for a while before using them as a garnish. Next, we've got a recipe for rhubarb cordial. I'm just going to go right to the recipe for this. It looks really, really good and sounds really yummy. This makes 3 cups. The serving size will vary. It takes 15 minutes plus 1 month to steep. Source, Drinking French, by David Leibovitz. You'll need 1 pound of rhubarb, trimmed and cut into 1/2-inch pieces, 3.5 cups of gin, plus more if necessary, 3 wide strips of orange zest, 1/2 cup of sugar, 3 tablespoons of Grand Marnier, Cointreau, or Triple Sec to serve, a splash of club soda, tonic water, or sparkling wine to serve. This is optional. Put the rhubarb, gin, orange zest, and sugar in a clean 2-quart jar. Also, 2 liters works. Cover and shake to encourage the sugar to dissolve. Store it in a cool, dark place, shaking it every few days for a month. This recipe is intended for room temperature. My kitchen runs hot, and I had it in the fridge instead for a couple weeks longer. After a few days, if the rhubarb is still floating above the level of the liquid, add another pour of gin, enough so that the rhubarb is covered. Use a fine mesh strainer to strain the liqueur into a large measuring cup or bowl with a spout. Add the Grand Marnier, pour into a clean bottle or bottles, and tightly cork. You can store the cordial for up to 1 to 3 months longer. Apparently, you can wait this full 1 to 3 months to drink it for proper aging. We absolutely did not. To serve, pour into small tumblers with a few ice cubes, a twist of orange or tangerine peel, and a splash of sparkling water, tonic, or sparkling wine as an aperitif. Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff, read by Gretchen Miller.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.